The handful of anti-militarists and critics of empire from the left, such as Noam Chomsky, and the right, such as Ron Paul, have been declared persona non grata by a compliant media. The liberal class has retreated into boutique activism, where issues of class, capitalism, and militarism are jettisoned for cancel culture, multiculturalism, and identified politics. Liberals are cheerleading the tension and crisis in Ukraine. At least, the inception of the war with Iraq saw them join significant street protests. The new conservatives and liberal interventionists chant in unison for war. Biden has appointed those warmongers whose attitude to nuclear war is terrifyingly cavalier to run the Pentagon, the National Security Council, and the U.S. State Department. Biden has appointed these warmongers whose attitude to nuclear war is terrifyingly cavalier to run the Pentagon, the National Security Council, and the U.S. State Department. Since all people do is war, all proposed solutions are military in the United States. This military adventurism accelerates the decline, the defeat in Vietnam, and the squandering of $8 trillion in futile wars in the West Asia North Africa region illustrate. War and sanctions, it is believed, will cripple countries rich in gas, oil, and natural resources. War or the threat of war will curb the growing economic and military clout. These are demented and dangerous fantasies perpetrated by a ruling class that has severed itself from reality. No longer able to salvage their own society and economy, they seek to destroy those of their global competitors. Once the militaries cripple countries, the plan goes they will focus military aggression on the Indo-Pacific, dominating what Hillary Clinton, as Secretary of State, referring to the Pacific, called the American Sea. You cannot talk about war without talking about markets. The United States, whose growth rate has fallen to below 2%, while China's growth rate is 8.1%, has turned to military aggression to bolster its sagging economy.
This is for a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, "I have been sent to complete noble manners."
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Dear brothers and sisters, السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. Welcome to For a Better Life. This is Javed Akbari speaking. Well, today we are going to talk about closeness and proximity to Allah, which is the goal of life, of course. And it's the goal of creation. It's the goal for which we have been created by Allah. And if this goal is achieved, a better life and obviously a felicitous and a happy life will be achieved. Every individual is in search of a better life, in search of happiness. And happiness, real happiness, if you look at the works authored by prominent scholars, by prominent mufassirin, exegetes of the Holy Quran, we see that happiness or a happy life is achieved in the afterworld. But this world is also has a role to play. It facilitates a happy life, but we have to make use of this world to achieve that happy life, because this world is transient, this world is fleeting, and in this temporary world and this transient world, You know, eternal happiness is meaningless and we cannot achieve it in this world. So we have to understand that eternal happiness or eternal felicity is something that is achieved in the afterworld, because that world is permanent. It is the permanent abode, the permanent realm, and therein we will live forever. So, brothers and sisters, man should make every effort possible to achieve closeness to Allah. There is no doubt that true and sincere iman and closeness to Allah will definitely have its impacts on a person's life. It will have qualitative and quantitative impact on our life. If we have true faith in Allah, if we are sincere and honest in our faithfulness, and then if we get closeness to Allah, then we will live a happy life. Of course, it will have its impacts on our life, even on our material life. In this world, we will live a happy life. If a person or a society obeys Allah and gets his closeness, gets pleasure, of course, divine pleasure, he will have more and more blessings. He will receive more bounties and blessings from Allah. Let's have a break. We will be back.
We were given so many prizes. We changed the desert into oases. We built buildings of different lengths and sizes. And we felt so very satisfied. We bought and bought and couldn't stop buying. We gave charity to the poor cause we couldn't stand the crying. We thought we paid our dues, but in fact, to ourselves we're just lying. Oh, I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
The Quran says, وَلَوْ أَنَّ أَهْلَ الْقُرَىٰ آمَنُوا وَاتَّقُوا لَفَتَحْنَا عَلَيْهِمْ بركات من السماء والأرض ولكن كذبوا فأخذناهم بما كانوا يكسبون. If the people of the towns had believed and guarded against evil, واتقوا, we would certainly have opened up for them blessings from the heaven and the earth. لفتحنا عليهم بركات من السماء والأرض. But they rejected. ولكن كذبوا. So we overtook them for what they had earned. فَأَخَذْنَاهُمْ بِمَا كَانُوا يَكْسِبُونَ. So verse 96 of chapter 7. The Prophet Nuh عليه الصلاة والسلام told his people, فَقُلْتُ اسْتَغْفِرُوا رَبَّكُمْ إِنَّهُ كَانَ غَفَّارًا. I said, ask for forgiveness of your Lord. Surely he is the most forgiving. And these are some verses which definitely indicate that if people maintain piety, if the people have true faith, وَلَوْ أَنَّ أَهْلَ الْقُرَىٰ آمَنُوا وَاتَّقَوْا, and if people have true and sincere faith in Allah, then Allah will shower His blessings on them. يُرْسِلُ السَّمَاءَ عَلَيْكُمْ مِدْرَارًا, He will send down upon you the cloud, pouring down abundance of rain. And he will help you with wealth and sons and make for you gardens and make for you rivers. And these are verses of the Holy Quran which clearly indicate and which clearly suggest that if we have true faith and belief in Allah, then Allah will shower his abundance and blessings upon us. And of course, this is all about material blessings, which are the results of faith and closeness to Allah. Abundance comes when a society or an individual truly believes in Allah. Iman and sincere belief in Allah will definitely have social effects as well. Those verses which I recited deal with material blessings. But what about social blessings, social effects? If a society obeys Allah and follows His laws, the divine laws, there will be no oppression. Every person will have the opportunity to have a comfortable life and to enjoy the results and the benefits of his activities. God says in verse 25 of chapter 57 that certainly we sent our apostles with clear arguments. لَقَدْ أَرْسَلْنَا رَسُولَنَا بِالْبَيِّنَاتِ with clear arguments and sent down with them the book. وَأَنْزَلْنَا مَعْهُمُ الْكِتَابِ وَالْمِيزَانِ that men may conduct themselves with equity. لِيَقُومَ النَّاسِ بِالْقِسْطِ. The book of God and the signs, God's apostles, the messengers, were sent down only to help us live balanced life, live with justice and equity and equality.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email that is englishradio@irib.ir.
One of the aims of the prophethood is to establish social justice, qist. In such societies, of course, people can be comfortable and they can easily perform their religious duties and reach divine pleasure. There is no doubt about it. And of course, taqwa, iman, piety, God consciousness and belief in Allah help us achieve perfection, help us achieve, you know, closeness to Allah. And obstacles in the process of self-improvement are removed. You know, the freedom from obstacles is one of the effects of iman, true iman, of closeness to Allah and achieving perfection. And of course, to be religious means to be devoted to Allah and divine values, of course. And when you are devoted to Allah, and when you are dedicated, then of course obstacles and the process of self-improvement will be removed. So definitely freedom from obstacles means that we should be free from false gods in the society. We should be free from bad habits, from bad customs, and from bad social norms and laws and superstitions. We have to get rid of these things. And of course, in the Holy Quran, we find verses that one of the jobs and one of the works, or maybe one of the purposes for which God sent prophets to humanity is to free them, is to free people from bad habits, to free people from superstitions and from ugly behaviors, ugly things. And it's only in the absence of such things, it's only by getting rid of superstitions and false beliefs and false gods that man can achieve perfection, and then he can achieve closeness to Allah, which is, of course, the ultimate goal for which a man has been created. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every grain of sand in every desert land, he knows. Every shade of palm, every closed hand, he knows. Every sparkling tear on every eyelash, he knows. Every thought I have and every word I share, he knows. Allah knows.
In the limelight.
The head of the Texas Department of Public Safety admitted on Friday afternoon, 27th of May, that of course it was the wrong decision for armed police to wait for an extended period of time outside the classroom where the gunman in last Tuesday's school shooting was killing children and teachers without storming in. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Richard Luscombe. The piece is titled "Texas Police Made Wrong Decision Waiting Outside Classroom," says official. In the United States, the head of the Texas Department of Public Safety admitted on Friday, 27th of May, that, of course, it was the wrong decision for armed police to wait for an extended period of time outside the classroom, where the gunman in last Tuesday's school shooting was killing children and teachers, without storming in. Police's updated timeline suggests that roughly 78 minutes passed from the time that the gunman entered the school building to when police officers finally entered the classroom where he was located. Meanwhile, students trapped inside the classroom with the gunman reportedly called 911, including one who pleaded, "Please send in the police now," as officers waited in the hallway for more than 45 minutes. Stephen McGraw, Department of Public Safety Director, shed tears and said at a tense press conference in Uvalde, Texas, where 19 young children and two school teachers were gunned down by a local 18-year-old, that there's no excuse for the failure of trained personnel not to have intervened sooner. At least 17 others were wounded, and the victims were all inside one classroom. At a separate news conference, the governor of Texas, Greg Abbott, showed no sympathy for the controversy facing law enforcement in Uvalde, saying that local police officials had initially misled him about the speed and resolve of police officers' response to the mass killing at the Robb Elementary School last Tuesday. "I'm livid," Greg Abbott said. "My expectation is that the law enforcement leaders leading the investigation get to the bottom of every fact with absolute certainty. The families whose lives have been destroyed need answers that are accurate." The mayor of Uvalde, Don McLaughlin, also claimed to be confused about Friday's revelations about the police response. And without elaborating, he said his staff would make any change needed if deemed necessary after an investigation into the police's response to the mass shooting. Stephen McGraw, Department of Public Safety Director, Greg Abbott, Texas's governor, and Don McLaughlin, Uvalde's mayor, all spoke on Friday as questions and anger mounted in the community over gaps in information, contradictory answers given to repeated questions from parents and journalists about what had happened, and silence on other topics about why more deaths could not have been prevented. The gunman, who had recently turned 18, came heavily armed to Robb Elementary School in the small town of Uvalde on Tuesday and killed 21 people after shooting and wounding his grandmother earlier. He was ultimately shot dead at the school by a federal agent. The attacker entered through a door that was meant to be locked but had been propped open, and after arriving in response to frantic calls from teachers trapped inside the school with the gunman barricaded in a classroom, armed law enforcement officers waited outside the door for about an hour while the killing continued inside the classroom. A specialist SWAT team, for which the officers had apparently been waiting, eventually breached the classroom and shot the killer dead. After several days of stonewalling and contradictory responses by other officials, Stephen McGraw led the press conference on Friday and cited the person in charge of the special police department assigned to the school without naming the person who, on the day, had led the response and held the officers back. "It was the wrong decision," Stephen McGraw conceded. The on-scene commander at the time believed it had transitioned from an active shooter situation to a barricaded subject, he said, adding the commander thought that, at that point, there remained no children at risk. Obviously, based upon the information we now have, there were children in the classroom at risk, he said. He choked up as he was asked about the apparent tragic error when people had continued to call the 911 emergency service number throughout the hiatus and tell them there were children needing rescue and frantic parents outside the school were pleading with other police officers there to move in and end the massacre. Asked about a 40-minute gap in which 911 operators were aware children were alive, but police officers still did not go in, he added, "The decision as made that this was a barricaded subject. There was time to retrieve the keys to the classroom and wait for a tactical team. That was the decision, and that was the thought process. With the benefit of hindsight, of course, it was not the right decision. It was the wrong decision. Period. There's no excuse for that," he said. Stephen McGraw recounted some of the 911 calls, including several from a female who, in a whisper, reported multiple dead in a classroom. The unnamed caller from inside the classroom said there were 8 to 9 students still alive inside the classroom at that stage. At 12:36 p.m. local time, a 911 call that lasted for 21 seconds was received from a child inside the classroom who was told to stay on the line and stay quiet. The child, Stephen McGraw recounted, said, "Please send in the police now." Earlier, demands for answers multiplied as it emerged that extra state spending on school security and police officers trained for mass shootings had not prevented the massacre. Victor Escalon, the South Texas Regional Director of the state's Department of Public Safety, said on Thursday armed officers arrived at the Robb Elementary School in about 4 minutes, yet it was approximately an hour later that a tactical team of U.S. Border Patrol arrived at the school, burst into the classroom and killed the gunman, while the other armed police officers waited outside. Victor Escalon had given incomplete answers to pointed questions from reporters at a press conference on Thursday about what had happened, including how the authorities had said that an armed officer tried to stop the shooter as he approached the school, then had said the opposite, that in fact there had not been anyone to intercept the shooter beforehand. Telling the media he would try to get more answers, he said at one point, "Could anyone have gone into the classroom sooner? You have to understand, this is a small town." On Friday, Stephen McGraw also addressed the subject of earlier statements about social media posts. "I want to correct something that was said earlier on the investigation, that the killer posted on Facebook publicly that he was going to kill his grandmother, and secondly, he was going to shoot up at a school. That didn't happen," Stephen McGraw said, adding that it was on a message to someone else. On 14th of March, the subject made an Instagram post saying, "10 more days," the director said, to which a respondent asked, "Are you going to shoot up a school? Stop asking dumb questions and you'll see," Salvador Ramos allegedly replied. Adriana Martinez, the mother of Salvador Ramos, said in an interview with CNN local affiliate, "Forgive me. Forgive my son."
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth, Eastern Tales. Roundtable Discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, having good behavior versus bad behavior. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of having good behavior versus bad behavior with our neighbors. Islam gives importance to the neighbor, and we know that the rights of the neighbors must be looked after according to the Islamic teachings. On the other hand, there might be some people who say that our neighbors are not good, and they do have bad behavior, and they deal with their neighbors badly. What is the answer of Islam to this behavior? We can see that Islam says that because they are your neighbors, you must have a good behavior versus their bad behavior. And you must not answer them the way they are dealing with you. You must answer them in the best way, in the best possible way, or in the decent way, with the decent behavior. And this will change their attitude gradually. In Islam, it is said, "Waj'alni." There is a prayer with Imam Zainul Abidin is saying, and he says, "Waj'alni Allahumma ajzi bil ihsani musi'ahum." O Allah, give me this power that whenever they are being evil with me, I'm answering them in the best way, in a good way, and I'm doing a favor to them. وَأُعْرِضُوا بِالتَّجَاوُزِ عَنْ ظَالِمِهِمْ. And keep me away from the oppression if they are doing that. So if we are answering them in a good way, in a good manner, in a decent behavior, it can change the behavior of neighbors when they see that all the time, when they're having the bad behavior, they're having a bad attitude towards us. But we are replying in the best way or in a good and decent way, it will change their behavior in relation to the others, inshallah. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. In today's lesson, we will be talking about the topic of having a good behavior versus the bad behavior of our neighbors. We said that Islam gives importance to the neighbors, and if our neighbors are having a bad behavior, we must deal in a decent way with them. On the other hand, we see that in the Islamic text, it is said that when your neighbors are having a bad behavior with you, you must forgive them. And this forgiving means that we are having a good relation with them. We are having a good behavior. We are answering them in a good way, in the best way possible. And even if they have maybe insulted us, maybe they are having a bad way of dealing with them, they talk us in a bad way, maybe they deal with other neighbors in the same way. So the best thing to do is to answer them in a decent way, and having the good behavior and decent behavior versus the bad behavior. But on the other hand, if we look and see that if we also answer them the way they were dealing with us, then obviously it brings troubles into the life. It brings insecurity in the neighborhood. It brings dispute amongst the neighbors. And therefore, the peace from that place will be gone. And this peace will flee away from that neighborhood. If we want this neighborhood to be the best neighborhood and a peaceful neighborhood, therefore, we need to make sure that even if our neighbor, a specific neighbor, is not having a good relation with others, we must have a good relation with that person so that he will be changed with the passage of time when he realizes that everyone is having a decent behavior except him, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
In the limelight.
Britain's Prime Minister Boris Johnson faced a barrage of criticism after he amended the rules on Friday, 27th of May, to make clear that ministers will not always be expected to resign for breaching the code of conduct. We now present you an article written jointly by Rowena Mason and Aubrey Allegretti. The piece is titled Boris Johnson Accused of Changing Ministerial Code to Save His Skin. Britain's Prime Minister Boris Johnson has been accused of changing the ministerial code to help save his skin ahead of a new Partygate inquiry that could publish more photographs and subject him to a public grilling by MPs. The Prime Minister faced a barrage of criticism after he amended the rules on Friday, 27th of May, to make clear that ministers will not always be expected to resign for breaching the code of conduct. Under new sanctions, they could apologise or temporarily lose their pay instead. Boris Johnson also blocked his independent ethics chief, Christopher Guite, from gaining the power to launch his own investigations and rewrote the foreword to the Ministerial Code of Conduct, removing all references to honesty, integrity, transparency, and accountability. It comes as the Prime Minister faces an inquiry by the Privileges Committee into whether he misled Parliament over lockdown parties at No. 10 Downing Street, which could itself be a breach of the ministerial code. Labour and the Liberal Democrats accused Boris Johnson of rigging the system to get himself off the hook ahead of the inquiry. No. 10 Downing Street said a new version of the ministerial code, published on Friday, 27th of May, alongside a government statement saying it is disproportionate to expect that any breach, however minor, should lead automatically to resignation or dismissal, has the backing of the Committee on Standards in Public Life and Lord Guite, the advisor on ministerial interests. British ministers who knowingly mislead Parliament are usually expected to resign, which is stated elsewhere in the Code of Conduct. However, Downing Street declined to say if Boris Johnson would resign if found to have done so. One reason given for changing the rules was to avoid incentives for trivial or vexatious complaints, which may be made for partisan reasons. Chris Bryant, the Labour MP and chair of the Parliament's Standards Committee, said the weakening of the system was appalling. Chris Bryant said, "The new ministerial code is a disgrace. It means that the tiny semblance of accountability disappears. If you break the rules, just rewrite the rulebook," is the motto of this despicable government. Johnson remains under severe pressure over Partygate after the publication of the Sue Gray report. On Friday, 27th of May, he suffered the first loss of a front bencher since the report. Ministerial aide Paul Holmes, who said his work as an MP had been tarnished by the toxic culture that seemed to have permeated No. 10 Downing Street. Bob Neill, a former minister and chair of the Justice Committee, also revealed he submitted a letter of no confidence in Boris Johnson recently. He said these events have undermined trust in not just the office of the Prime Minister, but in the political process itself. To rebuild that trust and move on, a change in leadership is required. Bob Neill later told the BBC that the change to the ministerial code of practice was not a wise move. Rebel MPs are planning to use next week's recess to plot ways to oust the Prime Minister. One critic said the number of letters of no confidence had to be in the 40s, short of the 54 required to trigger a confidence vote, but more than the almost 30 MPs who have gone public with criticisms of Boris Johnson. A senior Conservative MP said, "Boris Johnson's value to the party as Prime Minister is now exhausted, and events will take their natural course. I cannot tell you whether it will crystallise on 6th of June, after recess, or 27th of June, the return to Parliament after two by-elections. But the parliamentary party knows it cannot fight and win the next election under Boris." There is a widening gulf between the expectations of Johnson's allies and his critics, who expect to see him gone before the summer. One cabinet minister said he did not believe that Sue Gray's report had changed people's mind. He said either people are already bored of it or they are permanently enraged by it. I'm not sure anything is going to change now. But despite this confidence, Boris Johnson is facing a new headache with the start of the Privileges Committee inquiry within weeks, which is likely to keep Partygate in the headlines. Separately, it is understood the Greater London Authority's Oversight Committee is soon due to publish a report looking into London and Partners, the promotional agency linked to Boris Johnson's time as London mayor, and the revelations about his relationship with a US businesswoman, Jennifer Arcuri. Three ministerial aides, Laura Farris, Alberto Costa and Andy Carter, are imminently expected to resign from their government jobs in order to be more independent as members of the Privileges Committee that will sit in judgment over the Prime Minister's honesty. It is expected to launch within weeks before the summer break and to last 4 or more months. The committee can sit in private or call witnesses in public, potentially including Boris Johnson himself, and demand further documentary evidence, such as photographs from the government if required. Sue Gray published only 9 photographs in her report, but hundreds were seen by her inquiry. Harriet Harman, the senior Labour MP, is likely to chair the Privileges Committee, with a probe expected to ask what, if any, assurances the Prime Minister was given that the parties were legal when he claimed there were no gatherings and that all lockdown guidance was followed. Boris Johnson could be found in contempt of Parliament if he deliberately misled the House of Commons, but he could also be in breach of the ministerial code of conduct if he knowingly lied to MPs. However, the ministerial code is governed by the Prime Minister himself, and Boris Johnson resisted pressure to give Lord Gait the power to launch his own inquiries without consent. Under his revised terms of reference, there will be an enhanced process to let Lord Gait initiate inquiries, but he will still require the Prime Minister's consent before going ahead. Harriet Harman, the senior Labour MP, is likely to chair the Privileges Committee, with the probe expected to ask what, if any, assurances the Prime Minister was given that the parties were legal when he claimed there were no gatherings and that all lockdown guidance was followed.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Deep insight and firm determination, the most outstanding qualities of Hazrat Hamza. On January 25, 2022, Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, met with the officials of Hazrat Hamza International Conference. This is a part of his speech with the managers of this conference. In my opinion, there are two important qualities that constituted his personality. One is his firm determination and another is his insight. We must promote these qualities as much as we can. One is firm determination. Sometimes we believe in something but do not act on it because of our weak willpower. Having a firm willpower plays a decisive role. Hazrat Hamza became a Muslim in the 8th year of the Holy Prophet's Ba'tha. Those days were the hardest days for the Holy Prophet because Islam had just become announced publicly and the Holy Prophet and his companions were being attacked from all sides. The hardships that we have heard of are related to those years. During those very difficult circumstances for Muslims, that personality shouted in Masjid al-Haram, next to Kaaba, that he had become a Muslim and that he had believed in the Holy Prophet's religion. Such was his courage, his firm determination, and his insight.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Gaining a correct understanding of things is very important. We should teach ourselves and our people to think carefully on various matters and to make a correct decision. Had we but listened or used our intelligence, we should not now be among the companions of the blazing fire. They will then confess their sins. Chapter 67, verses 10 to 11. If we do not listen and think carefully, this is a sin. The Holy Quran says this clearly. According to the Commander of the Faithful, as quoted by Imam Baqir alayhi salam, peace and greetings be upon him, Hazrat Hamza was a manifestation of among the believers of men who have been true to their covenant with God. How does being true to their covenant with God take place? The full and complete form of it is to become a role model for divine teachings and divine commands and stepping forward for the path that God has specified. That is, such personalities become a manifestation of these qualities. We should learn this.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
The UN Special Rapporteur on the Situation of Human Rights in Afghanistan has concluded his 11-day trip to the country. Holding a press conference in Kabul, Richard Bennett expressed concern about the violation of human rights in Afghanistan, calling on the Taliban to abide by their promises.
Afghanistan is facing a plethora of critical human rights challenges that are having a severe impact on the population. I urge the authorities to acknowledge the human rights challenges that they are facing and to close the gap between their words and their deeds.
Mr. Bennett also called for investigation into blind terror attacks in the country, saying systematic attacks on Shia Hazaras involve marks of crimes against humanity.
I call for investigations into a series of attacks on places of worship and schools in Kabul, Kunduz, and Balkh provinces, instances of which have been claimed by the ISISK group. In particular, such attacks specifically targeting members of the Hazara, Shia, and Sufi communities are becoming increasingly systematic in nature and reflect elements of an organizational policy, thus bearing the hallmarks of crimes against humanity.
The UN expert also urged the international community to continue relief funds to Afghanistan, saying sanctions on the Taliban should not harm the Afghan people.
The humanitarian and economic crisis is very concerning, and I call on the international community to continue to provide humanitarian support and to ensure that the implementation of applicable sanctions do not substantially impede the provision of essential public services accessible to all, which are necessary for the enjoyment of human rights.
The independent expert advised the Taliban to form an inclusive government and establish fair engagement with the people if they want to end instability and suffering on Afghan soil. The UN expert's trip to Afghanistan comes as the country has been facing rights violations in different aspects. Afghan people hope their rights are protected and the international community closely watches developments in the country. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol promised to move the country closer to the United States, expanding trade and strengthening the military alliance. When Yoon recently hosted a summit with U.S. President Joe Biden, he went so far as to place his hand over his heart during the American national anthem, drawing condemnation from many South Koreans, including activists critical of U.S.-South Korea ties.
I believe it destroyed Koreans' pride. How can the president of one country do such a thing? I think Yoon Suk-yeol is a pro-American toady, and this act showed his unfiltered political inclinations.
Koo San-ha and her group demonstrated against the U.S.-South Korea alliance during Biden's visit.
The essence of the South Korea-U.S. alliance is to subordinate South Korea and give up South Korean interests to protect American hegemony and American interests.
In contrast, outside the U.S. embassy, one-man demonstrator Han Ga-ki says he has received a lot of support over his two-year-long vigil in favor of strong U.S.-South Korea ties.
South Korea, the United States, and Japan have come together to protect and defend liberal democracy. So the South Korea-U.S. alliance is essential. It's a matter of freedom being taken away or keeping your freedom.
South Korea is anything but a free rider when it comes to its alliance relationship with the United States. Seoul pays about $1 billion per year toward the cost of hosting 28,500 U.S. troops here. South Korea also spends billions of dollars on American weapons. In the wake of North Korea's recent missile tests, Yoon wants to see American strategic assets, nuclear-capable bombers and ships, conduct military drills in South Korea. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Hello, Commander. It's the title of a new epic song themed with support for the Islamic Revolution and its leader, from the mouth of Iranian children. The pop choir has recently been chanted in every corner in Iran, from TV shows to schools and public places. On Thursday, some 100,000 people jam-packed Tehran's Azadi Stadium to sing along Salam Farmande, Persian for Hello Commander.
Although we have not seen the Islamic revolution, but we as the new generation will hold on to the ideals of the revolution and our leader. This is the theme of this song.
Hello Commander is about our Imam Mahdi. In the song we urge Imam Mahdi hasty arrival to save humankind from cruelty.
The song addresses Imam Mahdi, the 12th Shia Imam and the prophesied apocalyptic savior in Shia Islam, who is believed to be currently living in occultation.
I brought my children to this gathering because they love Imam Mahdi. Here, they learn to be the soldiers of Imam Mahdi.
I came to show my love for Imam Mahdi. In the song, we assure our leader that we will be loyal to Imam Mahdi.
In a part of the song, children promise Imam Mahdi that they will tread on the path of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps' Quds Force commander, who was assassinated by the United States in Iraq in 2020.
In this song, we as the new generation vow to be the next Qasem Soleimani. We are proud of him because he brought us security. I wish he was here today.
The song was first broadcast from Iran's national television on March 20th this year, after leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, delivered a televised Persian New Year speech. Since then, the song has been performed in schools and national public occasions as a show of support for the Islamic Republic.
The notorious Azov Battalion, officially part of Ukraine's National Guard, their neo-Nazi roots are well documented, as are many of their crimes before the war started, such as the use of torture. Nazi-affiliated insignia remains a common sight on their clothing. Their base was in Mariupol, overlooking the Sea of Azov. They defended it fiercely against the Russians, but lost. Amongst the ruins, some anti-Azov graffiti. It reads, "Death to Fascism." And some more graffiti, perhaps written by an Azov member, it sums up their ideology. Life is slowly returning to the city, but people here will live with what they saw for the rest of their lives.
Yes, I witnessed Azov killing civilians. It was in Kurchatov Street. They were shooting from there, shelling blocks of flats, private houses, everywhere.
Each had three bazookas and a machine gun, and they started shooting. I can't say where they were shooting, because they locked us in the basement and warned if we attempted to leave, they would shoot us in the head. So we sat in the basement. The walls were shaking and they were firing with everything, with those American javelins as well.
Ask anyone in Mariupol who was here during the fighting and they will likely tell you stories like these, of Azov targeting civilian houses and of the use of hostages and human shields.
It's striking that everybody I've spoken to today here in Mariupol has no criticism of the Ukrainian army, who treated them well, gave them food, helped them evacuate, but that it's Azov, the Azov battalion, who mistreated them, using them as human shields and shooting them, targeting them.
The Ukrainian military have an aim to defend civilians, and they do it. But Azov ignore these rules, and they humiliate people in different ways. Once I saw them pull two women from the streets and drive off somewhere.
This is Konstantin Ivachenko, the new mayor of Mariupol.
We are finding traces of their crimes gradually. In the area of Mariupol airport, there are brutal places. There was a prison called the library, and all people who disagreed with the neo-Nazi point of view were tortured there.
Have you found any NATO weapons with Azov? Is there evidence that NATO has been arming Azov?
Yes, sure. We found stingers and javelins. After the city is reconstructed, we will put them on show. We have a lot of them. Lots of javelins.
While thousands of Azov members have either been killed or have surrendered in Mariupol, they remain a powerful influence in Ukraine. Not least because unlike many Ukrainian soldiers, they are ideologically driven to fight the Russians. As NATO weapons flood the country, many of them will find their way into the hands of extremists. Johnny Miller, Mariupol.
It took months to prepare, but it's finally here. Civil servant Sue Gray's report into allegations of rule-breaking parties under the British Prime Minister's roof during pandemic lockdowns. A report Boris Johnson repeatedly told Britons would be a moment of truth.
It's really quite damning because it demonstrates this culture of booziness right at the heart of government, particularly at a time when the rest of the country was in extremis, being locked down. People were dying and not being able to see their relations.
Only a day earlier, revelations the Prime Minister met with Sue Gray at the beginning of the month, allegedly to try and change her mind about publishing her report. and before that a police investigation that handed him, Chancellor Rishi Sunak, and several others a penalty. The report that blames top officials for breaking lockdown rules also comes in the wake of new photos of the PM